Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our distinguished guest today is His Excellency Kenneth Kaunda, who was president of Zambia from 1964 to 1991. After his retirement from politics, Dr. Kaunda became very active in the NGO sector, gaining particular renown for his efforts to address the AIDS crisis and for his founding of an NGO, Children of Africa Foundation. He is being honored in California by Project Concern International. Project Concern International mission is to prevent disease, improve community health, and promote sustainable development. President Kaunda, welcome to California.
Thank you very much indeed. You're most welcome.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born at a place called Lubwa Mission in Chinsali District, northern Rhodesia. Today's Zambia. I was born of missionaries. My father was a reverend. My mother was a teacher. They came from a place called Nyasaland, today's Malawi, and traveled to my home in northern Rhodesia. And I was born there as last born of my family.
Mm-hmm. And your mother was, I read somewhere, the first teacher in Zambia?
I'm afraid so, yes.
Was that good for you growing up?
Very good indeed.
Looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
From the teaching, two main commandments, Christ's teaching, love God your creator with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. We're teaching how to relate to our creator. Then comes the second one, second commandment, love thy neighbor as thou lovest thyself. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. These two commandments have stuck with me and have found them very useful in terms of guiding my thoughts, words, and deeds.
And you took these to both your careers. First, you were an educator before you became a political leader.
Yes, I was trained as a teacher at the same school, same place, because later on my parents were joined by missionaries from Scotland, from the Church of Scotland, Presbyterian, and they built a very important institution in terms of schools, health, and so I was brought up there.
Well, was it hard to make the transition from education to politics?
Not really, because even at the place where I was born, as I was growing up, I could see clearly the differences in terms of treatment between my parents and the white missionaries. Yet, both were missionaries. There was a difference in the way they were treated. So I began to talk about such things. And so that place also helped me to try and help build a better society, a society where human beings are human beings.
So you're saying that you sensed the way people were being treated differently, and so in your mind it became important to empower your own people to achieve that equality.
Precisely. That's very, very true. Correct. Yeah.
Now, you also, where I'm going here is I want to get a sense of political skills and how you learn them and your advice to students. But you worked for a while for colonial administrators. You honed your skills as a official of government in that way. Talk a little about that.
I trained as a teacher, and I worked at my school, my birthplace, as a teacher for some 3-4 years. And I left to go and look for better places, better life. And I visited Tanganyika then, Tanzania today, with two of my closest friends. We didn't like it. We went back home. Then I went to Salisbury, Harare today. Again, what I found there was terrible. So I went back home and worked as a welfare officer for some few months, 9 months, and then went back to teaching. From teaching, again, I didn't like it. I went back home to do farming, cooperative farming. From there, when I was teaching now at this second time, I was already involved in politics. Because this was what is called the Copper Belt, a very developed area in the northern Asia of our time. And there I got mixed up in politics. Mm-hmm. I never went back until I retired a few years ago.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could give our audience a sense of how you felt the excitement, because you are one of Africa's founding fathers. You were creating a political party which broke off from the ANC, so you were doing that ground-level work, but you were also leading a national struggle for independence.
Yes, that's true. As it happens, both the party which I formed after leaving the African National Congress and in African National Congress itself, we are both struggling against colonialism. So much as we differed in our approaches, I think it is important to relate to the fact that from time to time, we still came back together, especially when we are nearing the time of our independence. We're still quite close to each other in terms of fighting colonialism in such a way that at the end we still came back together to form a government of national unity, because we had been standing for same similar things, same principles, although we differed in terms of approaches. So yes, we differed from time to time, as I say, but in the end we understood and appreciated the fact that we were fighting for independence together.
At a certain point in this very difficult struggle, you were actually a political prisoner. Over the years on my program, I've interviewed a number of political prisoners, Wole Soyinka, among others. And I'm curious, what was the key to survival when you were in prison? Was it the cause that kept you going, or was it the inner strength that you had learned from your parents and your religion?
Well, the inner strength was there, it's true, but it was an instrument to fight for what we want to achieve. And therefore, the question you raise is very important, because from that, we managed to sort out what was required to be done. Mm-hmm. And once we got that, we had to find ways of how to get it. And this is where we found a way of struggling against colonialism, this time British colonialism in northern Rhodesia. And once we worked out the objective, we began to work out how to get that objective. And this is when we began to mobilize now and organize the people of Northern Rhodesia. And I used to do a lot of cycling because we had no other way of doing it. Cycling, visiting villages.
Bicycling, yes.
Yes, bicycling, yes. One day I met a big lion on the road. All those things.
Did you get his vote?
He ran away from voting. So it was an exciting time, but very, very difficult indeed. Tough, but it had to be done.
And did it sounds like as part of this communication and reaching people, was political education, which is what you were doing, was it like education that you had done, you know, when you were a teacher?
No, different. In the sense that when you went out to visit people in villages, in towns, for that matter, you were talking about what was wrong with the government. You were talking about what we should do in order to get a better situation for ourselves and for our children. This was different from what I was doing when I was a teacher. In the classroom, I was teaching kids, young people, young boys, young girls. But this time I was dealing with their parents. Mm-hmm. And to explain to them what was wrong, poor education, poor health services, what was wrong, bad roads, no food, and so on. These are things that one got at the center of the struggle. And that this could only be made better if we got our own government and controlled it, controlled things. That's how this came about.
Our interviews are watched a lot by students all over the world, and I always like to ask distinguished individuals like you to reflect on your life and tell us what insights you have about the skills that are required for political life. The students will deal with different set of problems, and we'll talk about those in a minute. But what it sounds to me like courage is very important, just starting off from what you've said.
Another very important question, Harry. First of all, there must be determination to do what is right, knowing that in the British system, you might have to go to prison, away from your family, away from everybody, and you're just going to be a prisoner. How long? You don't know. And it much depends on what you do, what goes wrong according to your colonial masters. You have to think of all these things. And once you make up your mind that you are determined to go ahead, regardless of what happens, then, of course, you say, yes, I am going to do it. God is great. God will guide me in my thoughts, in my words, in my deeds, whatever I think, say, and do. Once you decide that way, you are then ready to get moving in any situation, regardless of what comes to you. And then yeah, almost there.
People skills must be also very important. I mean, I know that you had to deal with ethnic differences and so on. So working with people also, and how do you learn that?
I think the first thing, Harry, is that you have to love people. First thing. You have genuinely to have feelings of love for your people. And when you look at what is happening in society, all that angers you, disturbs you, and so you decide, I am going to participate in this fight to establish something better so that my people can have something better than what we're going through now as a people. Then you ask yourself, am I ready to go to prison for my beliefs? If the answer is yes, it's very good, you go ahead. If you can't make it, you must be honest with yourself and say, I'm sorry, I cannot participate in this because I can't go to prison. I think that's how the approach is, was in those days. I'm sure it still is today.
Mm-hmm. When you achieved independence and you took over the government, mm-hmm. I mean, you must have had to really avoid despair because, I mean, it's not as if, for example, the British left you a university system, mm-hmm. an educational system in place. They didn't. You had to build it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. When we took over, Harry, we found 100 university graduates only. In 70 years of British rule, they produced only 100 university graduates. And of these, 3 were medical doctors only. That's all we had. And so when we took over, the first thing to do was education, health services, communication, roads, and so on. And we set to work on those programs. We established what was called 5-year development plans. The first time was, of course, 18 months to buy time to build proper 5-year development plans. And we got through that period with some little success, quite a good success, I must say. We were beginning new ones. And from there on, we got used to it, understood what we were doing. We accepted as a challenge. And we built. By the time we were leaving office in 1991, Harry, we had left about more than 35,000 university graduates in various fields. It was quite an achievement. We left, now this time, many schools, primary schools, colleges, and universities. We left clinics, dispensaries in various fields, various districts of the country. We have about 53 districts. We covered all these these facilities, district hospitals, ending up with general hospitals, one in each province, 8 provinces, and the 9th one was the capital. We built there a teaching hospital, what we called University Teaching Hospital. So we had established something quite decent by the time we were leaving office. We're very proud of what we achieved.
Mm-hmm. As you achieved independence and you governed your country, you're constantly have to dealing with the international economy. We now call it, the new word is globalization, the buzzword, but I think it would be interesting for our audience to have you reflect on the vulnerability of a poor country. Once it empowers itself to achieve independence, to begin its national politics, to actually navigate this international economy where suddenly the price of copper, for example, can fall precipitously. Talk a little about the problems that you confront in trying to realize the best intentions because of your dependence on the international economy.
Right. Another good question, Harry. You see, we were not only fighting for independence of Zambia. Northern Dish had become Zambia. We were also very much concerned with seeing to it that our neighbors in that region also become independent. Mm-hmm. Angola, west of us, Mozambique, west of us, Zimbabwe, south of us, southwest Africa, Namibia today, and of course South Africa itself. These were being run by colonialists, settlers, apartheid elements in society, people who did not believe that people of all races were God's children, people who believed that they were put on earth by God. They formed churches which were only for whites, and the blacks could not go there. So it became openly apartheid. Mm-hmm. So there in South Africa, it was there in Zimbabwe, it was there in Angola, Mozambique, and various colonial systems. And we decided that we had no right to say, yes, Zambia is independent. We had to do what Julius Nyerere, that great son of Africa, in Tanzania, Tanganyika in those days, was doing. Julius Nyerere brought in all liberation movements from these countries and gave them liberation centers in Dar es Salaam, the capital of Tanzania. And it was, we ourselves were there, Zambia and Northern Rhodesia. We were there, we had our own offices there. Now, as soon as we became independent, it was our duty now to do what Julius Nyerere had been doing. We opened our doors, and all liberation movements moved from Tanzania to Zambia. That meant being bombed from time to time by South African planes, war planes, Zimbabwe, Rhodesia in those days, the Portuguese in Angola, the Portuguese in Mozambique, the settlers in Namibia. All these were now attacking Zambia because they wanted us to be to fear that accommodating liberation movements meant being bombed, bridges being destroyed, you build, they bomb them again, and so on. Oil places where you hide your oil, they come and boil and destroy those. This is what life meant was. But it was something we had to do. When God says, love thy neighbor as thyself, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, there's no choice there. Mm-hmm. She understood that. We understood that. We accepted it. We worked together. And I remember one good missionary wrote a book about my humble self, and he asked President Nyerere to put an introduction there. And he said in this introduction, if Kenneth Kaunda and the people of Zambia had decided that was too difficult, like Dr. Banda in Malawi had done, we would not participate in the struggle. President Nyerere wrote, we all would have understood that this was the right thing for him and the people of Zambia to do. But he said they went ahead because they believed in what they were doing. So you can see that all other people who understood the situation there were realistic enough to make that point, that it's a very, very difficult situation. But we're committed. It is right that all people, God's children, should be free from oppression of other people. And today, it's wonderful to be able to say, yes, we suffered, but the price was worth it. Everybody now is free. Yes, we are making mistakes, but there are all mistakes in these governments, not foreign people making them for us. So we're happy with what we did.
So in a way, you're dealing with multiple problems in your role as the first president. You're empowering the people to enjoy their own resources and benefit from them. But at the same time, you're recognizing and fighting for the same goals for all your brothers and sisters in other parts of Africa.
Indeed, Harry, we it is perhaps important to point this out, that even in countries in Europe, for example, in America, when I went, I used to go to America and tell them about South Africa. I was supporting South Africa. I used to try to explain to them different governments. First one I gave here was to President Carter, a very good personal friend of mine. Harry, that man gave me 3 days of discussions, and very sympathetic. He understood what I was trying to do, and he was saying yes, he would help. We're going to work together, fighting apartheid. Now another one came in, Ronald Reagan.
Came in. From California.
From your California, yes. I went there again to explain this thing. And I could see the differences between the two. It gave me very little time, but at least I spoke to him for 1.5 hours, explaining, look, this is the meaning of apartheid to fellow human beings, and so on, so on, so on. He was listening. I thought he was listening carefully. And in the end, he said to me, Mr. President, let us do business together. That's what he said. While President Carter was listening and asking questions, what can we do here and there and there? President Reagan, all he could say was, Mr. President, let us do business together. I think what I meant, let us do business together in South Africa or over South Africa, I don't know. But that is all I got from him. And then, of course, you have people like Bill Clinton. President Clinton is a fighter with us. When I was arrested by my own president in Zambia after we left office, President Clinton sent a powerful message to him, either charge him or release him. So you can see the differences between leaders. Now, we go back to your point. This is what I'm trying to say here is, here you are, the West, on which copper markets depend, has leaders who may be supporting apartheid, who may be against apartheid. So for us, it was a tragedy when a leader who was supporting apartheid came into office in Europe. What I call my dancing partner, Margaret Thatcher, did not support our policies on South Africa. I can tell you one example. When we discovered oil, presence of oil on our soil in Zambia, an important oil company from America came to join us. They began doing wonderful things there, getting ready to start exploiting our oil resources. You know what happened? They appointed somebody called a resident director in Zambia.
To manage the oil.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you. And then one day he came to me, Mr. President, can you Can I invite you? Come and see what we are doing by way of exploiting oil in your own country. I said, most welcome. So I put him on my plane, the fighter, general, the government aeroplane. We went to a certain district. We found the military choppers there. We got in two of those choppers. We went to this place where the exploitation was taking place. Now, Harry, this was wonderful, really incredible. Big machines here and all over. Mm-hmm. A real development. And I was saying, thank God, thank God. Now copper and oil now will have power, real power. We'll be able to feed our people, do everything that we have been doing, even more. After a month or so, I received the shock of my life. All those machines I saw, temporary homes, were gone. I learned later that there was cooperation between the two, Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. They didn't like this talkative native president of Zambia. He's talking so much about South Africa and so on, all these Zimbabwe and so on. Can't feed him and his people. They paid, understand, some money, how many millions or billions, I don't know. But these people were taken out, this company of Zambia. So now what I'm saying is that when you have situations like that, your copper will only mind to a country if prices are good. Mm-hmm. But during my time, when I was talking too much about South Africa, Rhodesia, all these colonial countries, some Western countries did not like that. And so they punished me, a real punishment, by putting down the prices of copper. And by pulling out, people were going to provide a lot of money for my schools, my hospitals, and so on, so on. So you can see the problem that we have, and I hope that someday organizations such as the World Bank, IMF, and so on, will be able to perform in accordance with the requirements of the whole world, not just the developed world.
What I hear you saying is that it's not just the economic constraints of a poor, small country, but it's really the political constraints that they are placed under, especially if the leadership has courage, vision. Now, we're transitioning into a new world of globalization, a world in which at least parts of the world are sort of recognizing the common problems that we all face, poverty, disease, and so on. I know that in you are seizing this time to actually use your political skills and offer a vision that contributes to this. Do you believe that in solving some of these problems now, one really has to turn more and more to the NGOs to address problems such as AIDS and poverty?
I have said, Harry, that you have people like Bill Clinton, my friend Carter. You have many others. These countries in Europe, Scandinavian countries, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, even Holland, for that matter, a number of countries like that. In countries like Britain, America, you have ordinary citizens, also some of them NGOs, church leaders, who stand up against any type of destructive approach to these problems of development. the investors will invest, but if they don't have the right approach to problems, they will not use that money to also to help make profits, and I accept that. Investors are investing to make money, to make profits. It's welcome. It's right. It should be so. But once you make profits at the expense of the people whose copper, whose oil, whose this and that you're exploiting, you leave them completely with nothing. I cannot accept that type of thing at all. I'll fight that if I have the means to do so. When I was in office, this sort of thing I don't accept. When I stood on apartheid in South Africa, Rhodesia and so on, copper prices in 1980s went down miraculously in a terrible way. And we understood. So these things do happen. But I'm not saying all people in Europe, all people in America are bad people. No, I've told you two presidents I knew. My first man who introduced me to good politics was Abraham Lincoln. I read about him. He has influenced me very much indeed. So to me, color is immaterial. A human being, God says, love thy neighbor. This neighbor is not defined in terms of color. It's not defined in terms of tribe. Not even in terms of faith. Because all of us are God's children. He loves us. I was very happy. And President Bush kindly invited me to be present when he was announcing his Global Fund thing.
The Millennium Fund.
I was very happy. I was grateful. I haven't benefited yet from it, but when I do approach them, I hope they'll be able to help fund, that fund will be able to support my program. But I'm not taking that for granted. President Bush's organization can only support me once I go to them and give them my submission. This is what I want to do. If they think it's all right, it's good, they'll support it. That's how I think he invited me to be present at his launch of that good program. So this is how the world is. That's how I see it. But the most important thing, Harry, is for us to accept that we must work together in this world. I'm here, for example, to respond to the call by an important organization which has been working with us in Zambia.
This is Project Concern International.
Precisely.
Which has two projects, or several projects in Zambia. One focusing on vulnerable young people and supporting them, and the other is working with the Zambian military to fight AIDS and be educated. Yes.
Right. They do a wonderful job in Zambia. And therefore, when they kindly invited me to come and be honored together with 30 other organizations which they are going to honor, I readily accepted that. And I thanked God that there was an organization like that which could recognize, not only recognize, but also show to the world that they were appreciative of what the humble things my colleagues and I were doing in our organization and the other colleagues in other projects who are also being, 30 of them being ordered. That's a great move, I think.
And we should mention you have an NGO which is focused on the same kinds of problem called the Africa Children Foundation.
Yes, it's called the Kenneth Kaunda Children of Africa Foundation. We are fighting HIV and AIDS. Maybe you can see my, this badge here is for AIDS, fighting AIDS, Zambian flag, there down there, and up there it's fighting tuberculosis, not yet on malaria, but we'll soon be joining. We'll be having a badge on malaria, fighting malaria also. We're doing that because we concentrate on children, because that's the future of any world, any country, any place on earth. It's the future. The future is on what we do with children. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate very much what my colleagues here who have invited me on this organization, great important organization, are doing in Zambia and elsewhere.
You know, there's a continuity in our conversation, which is you're talking about the empowerment of your own people. They're realizing their national identity. The leaders of Zambia trying to navigate the international waters to help their own people. And in this new era, it almost seems like people like yourself have to bring your vision and your charisma and interface with the technical competences that might lie in the international realm to address these problems. What do we have to watch as we do this? Because we want to respect all that's been achieved by the people themselves in building their own world. But on the other hand, powers like the United States and Europe have an obligation to help.
Yes, that's true. What you're saying is true. Prejudice Concern International is a wonderful example of what you're talking about. They can't do that on their own, alone. That's why, in their wisdom, they identify other organizations, such as the ones they have now are going to honor here, in various parts of the world, especially Africa. They go there, they are doing some work on their own, but they also identify people who are doing something similar or who can do something similar to what they would like to do. So it's joint effort across anything artificial, just realizing and accepting that the human being is one God's child. Man east, man west, man north, man south. No woman should be angry with me that I'm leaving out a woman. It is every human being, east, west, north, south. And all of them must be looked after by all of us. Those who can do something must come together and do something about this. So that's why I'm saying that the world is not lost yet to the concept of Christ, of loving across anything artificial. And as I said, I include faith. These neighbors could be Muslims, could be Jews, could be Hindus, could be anything else, but accept that God's children. If they need, go there. If you can help, go there and assist. This is how I see this world. So I appreciate greatly Americans, Europeans, Indians everywhere who can cross barriers and go out and assist where this is required. Assist fellow human beings in building today's world. Much need. Just before we came out here, we're talking about street children in Africa, in Zambia. Today, they were not there before. During our time, they were in school. They were at school. We had built schools for them. Mm-hmm. Now they don't have enough schools, so they are in streets, and this is painful. And we say now, what can we do? Hence, forming Kenneth Kaunda Children of Africa Foundation. We can't do it alone. We come here, and this organization honors me, honors 30 more, 30 others. A wonderful thing to do.
As we talk and you reflect on your career, I see and hear very strongly the idealism, the man of principle, But as a leader of a country and an international figure, you're also a man of politics. I'm curious, how does one, and have you over time, reconcile these two trajectories? Because they do go in different places, and the challenge is to bring them together. Is it with education? Is it with talking to people, hearing what their concerns are, and then trying to move them to a different ground?
Harry, if we approach politics as a dirty game, we are very much on the wrong course, because politics is supposed to be an instrument of justice, fair play, good behavior towards your fellow human beings, regardless of color. When I come here and look at you, you look at me, nothing crosses me about your color. Absolutely nothing. I just see you as a fellow human being. In any situation, Harry. So once you make that program, that approach to life, you then are prepared to suffer for fighting and ending AIDS. You must do everything possible to help fight AIDS, regardless of people who are involved. At the moment, the highest, the most hit, hardest hit part of Africa is our region, Southern Africa, by AIDS. And I've not stuck to my own small country and left others. It's my duty to cross borders and talk to my brothers and sisters about AIDS. Within the country, I must talk to everybody. For example, One day, I was working with an American organization. They asked me whether I could help by going to get tested for AIDS. I said, of course, yes. So I went, I got tested. And results, it was negative. But I said, Harry, even if I had been found positive, I would have made that public. And I would have continued to use it to fight AIDS, because this is stigma thing must be destroyed as part of the struggle against AIDS. And at least I'm glad to say, they tell me that it has, my participation has helped the less stigma. It's still there, needs to be fought, but at least we have begun to fight stigma in a practical manner. So what I'm saying is, in every field, we need to accept our role to help human development. For example, you can't fight AIDS any other way without fighting poverty, first and foremost. We must fight poverty. If we defeat, to defeat AIDS, we must defeat poverty. My appreciation, Harry, of what's happening in America, in Europe, for example, less AIDS problems there, in these places, because they treated poverty. And if you look at people who are suffering mainly from AIDS in these countries, it's the poorest of the poor. So we have a duty to fight poverty in all these places. And that's why those who invest in Africa must invest, make profits, all right, it's their right. But as I said earlier, let them think of the people whom they found there, where they invested. What are they doing to help? And some of the people I worked with in my days when I was in government, before we took over control of the government, were good people. They were white, but they understood what we were doing. For example, football is a game which can be used very much to help fight AIDS. Mm-hmm. And we used it that way. These companies formed football teams in their own names. Mm-hmm. It helped. We can still do that today.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're saying that in this new realm, in this new world, we've moved from empire, end of colonialism, nationalism, national development, now in this globalized world, that we have to have hope and faith and organize people-to-people contacts. That in some ways, just as you're no longer in government, the new playing field is really the NGOs, the people-to-people contact, always linking kind of a vision with real technical people who know how to fix things, whether it's educating the military about AIDS or helping the children who are now not in school but on the streets.
Well analyzed, Harry. Well analyzed. That's exactly what my thoughts have been, are, and are going to continue to be. Because we have no other way out of our situation today. When we speak of globalization, what are we talking about? Globalization is the meaning of you understand that our world is one. And there's only one person in that whole world. Different colors, all praising God. Different tribes, different faiths, and so on. We all must accept our position that we are all God's children. We know him. We go to him through different paths, if you like. But we all are his. Who are we to say he made you white and therefore he was wrong? He made you black, therefore he was wrong. He made you brown, red. Maybe one day he'll make some green, I don't know. They will still be accepted, acceptable to my mind. They are human beings, God's children. Once we accept that, across anything else, globalization will have meaning. But if we don't accept that, we have no right to play around with globalization.
We have only a few minutes left, and I have one question I always like to ask distinguished individuals such as yourself. What advice, if students watch this tape and they look at your life, what advice would you give them based on your life as they prepare for the future?
Nothing better, put into action, love your neighbor as yourself, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you.
On that very positive and moving note, President Kaanda, thank you very much for coming to San Diego to be honored by Project Concern International, and thank you for participating in our program today. It was a great honor.
I'm grateful, Harry. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv.